The Johnson Wax Program. The makers of Johnson's Wax, Johnson's self-polishing glow coat, and Johnson's Car New present the brilliant conductor-composer of melody, Meredith Willson, and MGM's noted young commentator star and teller of amazing tales, John Nesbitt. Ladies and gentlemen, this program, in the words of John Nesbitt and the music of Meredith Willson, with songs by Connie Haynes and Bob Carroll, is sent to you by S.C. Johnson & Son, makers of Johnson's wax finishes for home and industry. And now, here are Meredith Willson and John Nesbitt. And I see from the program notes that these gentlemen have planned a light and romantic bill of fare this week. What's the story, John?
Why, Harlow, since Meredith has been sort of scooping me on that idea of his of discovering lost music that's been so successful this summer, I decided to do some detective work myself, and tonight we're presenting a lost story.
But what is it about?
Harlow, it will curl your hair, period.
Meredith, he's back talking about our hair again, so there's nothing to do. How about the music?
Nothing more hair-curling than a dozen melodies, Harlow. The America Sings group to close, a new lost music find, and, of course, a march to start us off. And speaking of the march, you know, all of us agree with the flag in every home committee that every single home in the country should have an American flag in it, whether it costs $100 or a quarter. Every hour of the day, it will remind us of the country we now must place first in all our thoughts and all our work. So tonight's march will be, "You're a Grand Old Flag."
Department of Lost Music, songs that should have been hits but never had a chance. And here's John with tonight's story of lost music.
This melody was written by a young man whose songs have sometimes topped the nation's lists of hits, among them the one that won the Academy Award of 1940, the song called "When You Wish Upon a Star." But moving picture music is a hazardous affair. In 1937, this composer wrote a red-hot beguine for Walt Disney. A beguine, Meredith tells me, is one of those South American rhythms where your feet dance to a slow tempo while your hips bounce around to a fast tempo. At any rate, the composer, Lee Harleen, considered this one of his best numbers. But at the last moment, something went wrong with the animation of the picture. Walt Disney had to cut it out, and the music was lost. Lost until Meredith Willson turned it up last week for the Department of Lost Music. And since it has neither words nor title, we can merely identify it a trifle foolishly as the Lost Beguine of Lee Harleen.
Thank you.
melody once forgotten on the floor of a studio cutting room comes out of oblivion to our Department of Lost Music. And Harlow Wilcox is here for a moment to speak for the Johnson Wax Company.
There's one thing car owners are learning now, many of them for the first time. You can't just put your car away and forget about it. Like any piece of good machinery, you've got to keep it up to keep its value up. That goes for the battery, for the tires, and it goes for the finish, too. Road scum will damage the finish of your car if it isn't removed. Even the dirt accumulation and temperature changes in a garage or parking space will cause damage. So even if you're not driving your car very much these days, you'll still lengthen the life of the finish and keep it new-looking if you clean and polish it with Johnson's Car New. I can tell you that's an easy job, because Car New both cleans and polishes in one application. Two jobs at once, in quick time. Car New is a liquid. You apply it, let it dry, wipe it off. It does an amazing job of bringing back your car's original showroom shine. If you want to give the finish added protection, apply a coat of Johnson's Auto Wax, or the regular Johnson's Wax. But first, clean and polish the car with Johnson's Car New, spelled C-A-R-N-U. Which brings us now to one of the highlights of our series, An Amazing Tale from John Nesbitt. Since, like Meredith's musical specialty of lost music, this is a lost story, it has been scored with one of the most popular lost melodies of the summer, A Handful of Stars. John Nesbitt.
In 1937, to my office on the MGM lot, came another writer with a story about a mysterious gold necklace. He explained that it was true that he'd been in newspaper work in 1932 and had had mutual acquaintances with the man who had sold the necklace. Very much interested in making it into a passing parade picture, we asked the legal department to find the original owner of the necklace and get permission to use his name. But he was gone without a trace, and ever since, the story has lain unauthenticated in the studio files. But it may be that someone who hears it tonight may furnish a clue as to whether it is true or false, or where the owner is today. And here it is, exactly as related to me 5 years ago by a responsible newspaper man who vouched for its truth. The story of a golden necklace. The scene is Pasadena, California, in the year 1924. Living at Pasadena then was a young couple, newly married and quite confident of making pots of money in the merry world of the gilded 20s and then settling down to prosperous middle age. Upon their marriage, the young man received a legacy from the will of an old aunt of his, a once aristocratic Frenchwoman who had died in Paris. Fond of her American nephew, she left him a plain, old-fashioned golden chain or necklace, which was perhaps her only little treasure. It was left with the proviso that he was to receive it upon his marriage with the idea that he would present it to his wife. During the 20s, the young American housewife never wore the ornament, simply because such things are only seen nowadays, draped over the ample bosom of elderly governesses and certain Park Avenue dowagers of rare old vintage. The chain was one of these plain gold affairs worn twice around your neck and hanging down nearly to your middle, where usually dangles one of those quaint old Swiss watches made of glass about the size of a marble. The chain had very little value, being of low carat gold, it was assumed, and it obviously never cost much money. A plain, old-fashioned necklace. And as the 1920s moved along, the Pasadena couple had no need of any money themselves. 1930 changed this abruptly. By 1932, they were completely without funds or property. And then, a real tragedy struck. The young wife contracted a fatal illness and died, leaving her husband to support two tiny daughters. The husband had to do what came to so many of us during the pit of the Depression, take his children and move in with relatives. His people were in the East. He pawned his wristwatch, sold extra suits of clothes, the furniture, and with $200 went to join his elder brother's family in New York City. He arrived just as his brother lost his job. And for the first time in his life, he faced actual starvation. So he took the old-fashioned gold chain, marched into a Sixth Avenue pawn shop, and offered it for sale. The proprietor glanced at it, tossed it back in the counter. Not interested. Too old-fashioned for good risk. Sorry. And yet, at a gold content of even 10 carats, such an ornament should fetch as much as $200. Stubbornly, he went into a larger jewelry store. There, the jeweler tested it with his solutions, weighed it, then pulled out his strong magnifying glass, put it to his eye, and examined it carefully. He looked up, dropping the necklace idly to the black velvet pad, and gruffly made an offer. He was a master bargainer, but he made a bad mistake. He said, "If you want the cash now, I can give you $2,000. It's the best I can do at a time when nobody's buying things like this." The young man stood completely stunned for a moment, then clutched up the necklace, jammed it into his pocket, and ran out of the store. $2,000? Why, if that man offered so much, it must be really valuable. But how? It's ugly, it's dirty, and there are thousands of these things knocking about in the antique shops of Europe. What is it about this particular one? That afternoon, he took his necklace to a larger jeweler. The appraiser went into a back room, came out briskly, and said, "It's not in our line, sorry. We might find a buyer for it, but in the market today, not more than 18 or 20,000. You'd better try a museum." Now the young man shook his head like a punch-drunk fighter, certain that he was dreaming in daylight, and he took the chain back to his brother. That night, the two men examined it carefully. There was no carving to speak of. His brother knew a friend who owned one exactly like it. It was simply a piece of jewelry for the old gold pile and the melting pot. The following morning, the two men together went to one of the greatest jewelry firms in the world, an establishment in New York where gems costing $100,000 can be purchased, where imperial jewels are sold to America's oldest families. They placed the necklace before the appraiser, who glanced at it and instantly rejected it. "Why, gentlemen, we don't deal in this sort of thing. I suggest a pawn shop or one of the smaller antique establishments." "But," said the dumbfounded owner, "I've just had an offer of $19,000 or $20,000 for it." The appraiser looked curiously at him, picked up the necklace, placed his magnifying glass to his eye, an instant later dropped it. "Why, of course, I beg your pardon, sir. Please step into the appraisal rooms. I assume you have credentials proving your ownership of this necklace?" It was too much. Inside the partition booth where the great jewels are privately examined, the owner planted himself at the table and clutched his necklace. "Now, look here. You tell me why this darn thing is worth money, or I'm going quietly mad." "You mean you don't know?" "I mean I'm about to start a riot unless they find out right now." The appraiser took the necklace, placed it on a velvet square, turned on the strong lamp over it, and seated the young man before it. Then he took a powerful magnifying glass, gave it to the owner, and told him to focus it over the inside of the clasp. He bent over, gazed through the glass, and at last he understood. For in minutely graven words in the French language, half obliterated by grime and wear, he read a single sentence: "Napoleon to Josephine, forever, 1796. And on each and every link of the chain, in microscopic letters, were the initials N and J, entwined in the manner of ancient France. History records that 136 years before, a rising young army officer from Corsica had met and courted a none too respectable woman named Josephine Beauharnais. He had fallen so madly in love with her that sometimes he would write her 8 letters in a single day. He showered her with presents, little and great. And either shortly before or after the marriage that would one day make her an empress and finally break her heart, he had given her a plain gold chain. And in the years to come, the soldier would conquer Europe, become Emperor of France, Napoleon I, and then he would cast Josephine out of his life. But in the year of their marriage, the gifts were engraved, "Napoleon to Josephine forever." of jewelry you see in the old gold pile in a jeweler's window has a story to tell. Always of some man's love or passion. But gold outlives the human heart. And through the world, these jewels and ornaments move today. Headed toward the melting pot, the names inside the wedding rings and necklace clasps, totally forgotten. So that each one like this is a lost story of the passing parade.
According to Meredith, which is sure to outlive the costliest present, is an old song. And of the simple melodies of America, he has one of the largest collections in the country. Hence, to the chief musical offering of the evening, and to Meredith himself.
The fact is, Harlow, I'm as sentimental about old tunes as some people are about old jewelry. For even though many of the melodies we danced to or sang in the barbershop quartets are not fancy art songs, they are part of the heartbeat of our country. And nobody who has ever had any fun out of living in America ever quite forgets the tune he heard when he took his girl to a musical show or gallantly plunked his ukulele on a moonlit veranda, whether his name was Bud Jones, Willis Learnclerk, or Spencer Tremble. Yet many of these tunes are better music than we know, which is why I think that many little songs like these may someday become the folk songs of tomorrow.
You if you don't watch out.
And if he ever bites you, then you sing and shout.
You'll go da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da and wo-dee-do-dee-do. That's what love is all about. The love bug will bite you if you don't watch out.
And if he ever bites you, then you sing and shout.
You'll go da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da and wo-dee-do-dee-do. That's what love is all about.
Go crazy. You just lie, meow, meow all day.
And if someone wants to know why you're crazy, you'll answer da 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 do with a ho hey. A love bug will bite you if you don't watch out.
And if he ever bites you, then you'll sing and shout.
You'll go da di da di da di da and wo di do di do. That's what love is all about. Everybody's been knowing going. And for weeks they've been sewing every Susie and Sam. They're congregating for me and my gal. The parson's waiting for me and my gal. And sometime I'm gonna build a little home for two, for three or four or more in love land for me and my gal.
Right now, I have a challenge for the strong men of this country. How would you like steering a destroyer at full speed through the lashing North Atlantic, catapulting trim scout planes from the flight deck of a battleship, trailing a submarine, dodging its torpedo, and finally getting the sub with a depth charge, manning an anti-aircraft gun from a cruiser deck as it guards a convoy through the attack of enemy bombers, speeding to the attack in a mile a minute in a deadly PT boat, or stripped to the waist, loading the big 16 inches of our newest super battle wagons as they fire at the enemy across 10 or 15 miles of ocean. That's the Navy, and more. Navy men are always in top physical shape through 3 big meals a day, plenty of recreation and sports, free medical and dental care, and sympathetic understanding and guidance from the officers. Small wonder that our Navy is winning more than its share of the medals and the glory for jobs well done. Tomorrow, at your first opportunity, go to the nearest Navy recruiting station. There you will learn all about what the Navy offers, explained to you by men who've had these same jobs themselves. Get a copy of the 48-page booklet called Men Make the Navy. It contains over 70 photographs describing Navy life and its opportunities. So see your local Navy recruiting office tomorrow. The Navy wants you. This announcement does not apply in Canada.
Time remaining only to say until with Meredith Wilson, Connie Haynes, Bob Carroll, and Harlot Wilcox, we join you again a week from tonight. This is John Nesbitt bidding a very good evening to you all.
Speaking for the makers of Johnson's Wax Finishes for Home and Industry, this is Harlow Wilcox inviting you to be with us again next Tuesday night. Good night. This program has reached you from Hollywood. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is Chicago, WMAQ.